Imaging.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm. As expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at buyer risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
This is that Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. I'm very, very troubled by Elon Musk's apparent decision to step down as CEO. He's been doing such a brilliant job with Twitter. Preliminary to that, we have a Twitter file supplemental. The DHS and FBI demands were so pervasive that even top woke Twitter executive began to think the government was going too far. Fascinating. Matt Taibbi has filed a supplemental threat to his review of DHS and FBI instructions. Just as a reminder, how the ask actually took place is still a mystery. Taibbi and Weiss and others are only privy to the internal actions and discussions after the inbound requests arrive. Put another way, we are blind to the method of the DHS FBI portal into the network. I do not believe that secrecy is accidental. And this is a Sundance at the conservative treehouse. The essence of Taibbi's supplemental report is based on a few internal emails amid the group following DHS, FBI, and ODNI, that would be the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, telling the Twitter rulers they were not cracking down hard enough on the platform content. I mean, this is so grotesquely violative of the First Amendment, you got to understand, which is a constraint on the government that it's not allowed to interfere with Americans' freedom of speech or freedom of the press, not to mention freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, and so forth. This is just grotesque. As Taibbi notes, the questionnaire authors seem displeased with Twitter for implying in a July 20th DHS, ODNI, FBI industry briefing that you indicated you had not observed much recent activity from official propaganda actors on your platform. Twitter official Yoel Roth then responded to the U.S. intelligence community in a series of back-and-forth conversations and internally to the Twitter censorship group. As noted by Taibbi, Roth was not comfortable with the Bureau and by extension the IC, intelligence community, demanding written answers. Tiabi then seemed to pull out the pretending not to know things card and ponders. The idea of the FBI acting as a conduit for the intelligence community is interesting, given that many agencies are barred from domestic operations. Gee, you think? Go figure, at Sundance. Within the short thread, the intel community is responding to Twitter with citations from mainstream media publications like the Wall Street Journal. However, the citations from the Journal are sourced from the same intel community, citing them as evidence. It's a proverbial and circular use of the wrap-up smear. Intel community seeds media with false or manipulated narrative. Media prints false or manipulated narrative. Intel community then use media printed story as citation to tell Twitter to act on it. Have we seen this before? Very, very good. But just when Twitter's doing all this brilliant work, all this expose, and where I had not originally anticipated how Musk taking ownership meant he would, of course, immediately have access to all this past communication and be able to expose it. Not that just any owner would do that, but which he has, and in my opinion, doing a magnificent job. I'm just appalled. Elon Musk proclaims he may decide to step down as Twitter CEO within hours. Elon Musk proclaimed he would step down as Twitter CEO if the users of the popular social media platform demanded his removal. Why in the hell, when he knows how much it can be manipulated, would he ever propose such a thing? Musk conducted a new poll at 6:20 p.m. on Sunday, asking his more than 122 million followers if he should abdicate his leadership role on Twitter. Musk tweeted, "Should I step down as head of Twitter, I will abide by the results of this poll. This, in my opinion, is incredibly stupid." At the time of publication, unless, of course, he wants to step down, but he wouldn't need a poll to do that. At the time of publication, nearly 5 million had voted in his poll. Approximately 58% called for Musk to step down, roughly 42% who wanted him to retain his Twitter CEO duties. The poll expired around 4:20 this morning. I'm just appalled. A Twitter account suspected Musk already has a new CEO picked out. The user hypothesized. Elon will retire to being chairman of the board and Twitter. Musk replied, "No one wants a job who can actually keep Twitter alive. There is no successor." Musk responded to another Twitter user, "The question is not finding a CEO. The question is finding a CEO who can keep Twitter alive." Popular podcast host, computer scientist, and artificial intelligence researcher Lex Fridman offered to be the Twitter CEO for free. Fridman tweeted, "Fun suggestion at Elon Musk. Let me run Twitter for a bit. No salary, all in. Focus on great engineering and increasing the amount of love in the world. Just offering my help in the unlikely case it's useful." Musk replied, "You must like pain a lot. One catch. You have to invest your life savings in Twitter, and it has been in the fast lane to bankruptcy since May. Still want the job?" Despite the conditions, Fridman still wanted the job and vowed to turn it around. There have been multiple controversies and eye-opening events since Musk acquired the social media network. Musk helped release the Twitter files. Twitter temporarily suspended several journalists for reportedly doxing his exact location in real time, which, of course, makes him a target for assassination. So that banning was completely appropriate and briefly banned Washington Post tech writer Taylor Lorenz. Musk spent part of his Sunday watching the World Cup final between France and Argentina, which Argentina won, with Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of former President Donald Trump. Why he's cavorting with Gerald is questionable to me, because as I see it, Jared Kushner has not been working to benefit Donald Trump. Now, Trump, of course, is easily the most controversial political figure of our lifetime or any lifetime, and I think it's for a lot of good reasons. Here's a fascinating piece, by the way, from the anti-New York Times. Psst. Trump is a psyop. He works for the Jews and Big Pharma. He has murdered a million people with his vaccine already. Pass it on. Attacking Trump from the far right, a deep state trick by Mike King, who publishes the anti-New York Times. If you've never read his stuff before, you really need to, because it's incisive and leads to lots of insights you wouldn't otherwise normally secure. Until the long-awaited sting operation, commonly referred to as the storm, moves from the behind-the-scenes stage to the open-to-the-public grand finale, and it's coming. It is perfectly natural and rational for folks in the conspiracy theory community to maintain a degree of skepticism as to Trump's intention and or ability to pull off the plan set forth by Q. Indeed, in spite of our continuing optimism here at Real History Chan, we have never guaranteed that the plan will succeed in the end, only that it does exist and that it has achieved many substantial victories to date. For that persistent remnant of used guys who say that Trump is one of them, we respectfully pose the following questions. Who saved us from Hillary Clinton's planned hell on earth? Who arranged from behind the scenes to put the mighty Harvey Weinstein in jail? Who put Mossad blackmail assets Epstein and Maxwell in jail? Who saved Assad regime of Syria? Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah did the fighting while Trump defunded the CIA Mossad rebel ISIS. Who defunded CIA Mossad ISIS, causing the mercenary army to wither away? Who got us out of the Middle East entirely? Who ended the dangerous Korean Cold War? Who defanged and deballed NATO? Who cleansed the entire GOP of Jew, neocon, Israel firsters? Who put the Bush dynasty out of business? Who put the Cheney dynasty out of business? Who put the Cuomo dynasty out of business? Who put the McCain mafia out of business? Who forced or maneuvered nearly 100 rhino globalist Republicans out of Congress? Who made it acceptable again to call extreme liberals by the proper label, communists? Who fired the untouchable Henry Kissinger and Madeleine Albright from the Pentagon board? Who won the loyalty of the Zio-Christians to such an extent that their Mossad-financed pastors cannot possibly undermine Trump? Who said, F Netanyahu? Who split the Israeli lobby in two? Who got us out of the Paris climate scam? Who got us out of the TPP, World Government Trade Deal? That's Trans-Pacific Partnership. Who stopped the anti-white replacement of Jackson from the $20 bill with Harriet Tubman? Who thwarted the five-year COVID lockdown scheme and the Great Reset, which was to follow? Who waged war upon and discredited the fake news like no president before? Who is about to blow election fraud wide open? Who got rid of Roe v. Wade, a move which has already banned abortion in numerous states? Who took away the EPA's power to regulate CO2 emissions? Who fired global warmest fake scientists from government agencies? who stood before the UN and WEF and boldly denounced globalism right to their faces? Who saved us from the pre-planned war, World War III, with Russia and China? Who has fought the scourge of child sex trafficking and abuse like no other before? Who, through his collaboration with Q, informed millions of folks about the satanic globalists? Who has been viciously attacked by deep state fake news 24/7, 365, ever since 2015? Who do Satanists and child rapists fear and hate more than anybody? Who put his life at risk and brought so much hatred down upon himself for your sake? Who will soon return to the presidency, which he never really abdicated? Answer: Donald Trump. While acting as the front man for the Worldwide Military Patriot Alliance. That's who. And much of this was achieved while playing the strategically necessary game of diversion and optics. Not by foolishly screaming, "Da Jews, Da Jews, Da Jews," as some of our purest brethren on the far right demanded. No hard feelings here against any of you guys who still deem the plan too good to be true. After all, with the notable exception of the 1930s glory days of Germany, we, the good, have been getting our asses kicked up and down the football field for about the past 120 years now. And even if the globalist deep staters were about to be wiped out in one fell swoop, what to do about the increasingly blending out white masses of Western normiedom, which include the folks in the lands down under, who have by now been so mentally, morally, and spiritually damaged that it would take many years to repair their lost minds and souls? Yes, your skepticism and even despondent pessimism is totally understandable. Where the proverbial line must be drawn, however, is where, when silly slanders about Trump being a Red Shield-owned false opposition, Jared Kushner, Jeff Jab, and Q being a Jewish psyop started circulating. Such absurd assertions are not merely false, but are themselves part of a true clever psyop engineered by the usual suspects and executed by their agents within our ranks. The objective? To undermine and bitterly divide Trump's support base by attacking him from the far right. Now, where have we seen this tactic before? Let's see. The Sunshine Patriots and the Are We There Yet chorus fail to appreciate the magnitude of what Trump has been up against and what the White Hats are attempting to pull off. Wilbur Ross, Trump's Secretary of the Interior, worked as a bankruptcy reorganizer specialist for NM, Press Shield, and Sons in New York, and helped Trump before starting his own company. Based on that connection, the naysayers and the dupes accused Trump of being a Red Shield puppet, smearing Q as a Bolshevik psyop based on the 1920s Operation Trust is another of these trick of these people. QAnon bears striking resemblance to Bolshevik psyop from 1920s known as Operation Trust, Information Liberation publishes. Here's a Trump tweet. "I'm just fighting to save our country." It's true. In 1923, Adolf Hitler won a lawsuit against Vorwärts, a Jewish-owned Marxist newspaper that had falsely accused him of being funded by, get this, American Jews. Below is a complete text of the 1923 bulletin published by the Jewish Telegraph Agency in the USA. Berlin avorts to pay 6 million marks damages. How interesting, 6 million. For saying Hitler got Jewish and poured money. Adolf Hitler, leader of the Bavarian Fascisti, was awarded yesterday 6 million marks. Editor note, not much due to hyperinflation. Damages in his libel suit against the editor of the Vorwärts, the socialist daily of Berlin. The libel proceedings against the socialist editor were instituted by the reactionary leader of Bavaria following the publication of the Vorwärts of a report that the Hitler organization was receiving financial aid from American Jews and Henry Ford. Leftists and homosexual rivals within Hitler's early NSDAP, such as the treasonous Brother Strasser, would later start similarly whispering campaigns aimed at undermining Hitler's support base. Hitler had Jewish blood, they said. Hitler was a secret Bolshevik, they said, to this day. There are certain charlatans and ass clowns, usually pretending to be white nationalists, smearing the Great One as a Redshield and an agent of London. It's a clever and all too often effective ploy, and it is today being utilized by these very same pretenders, some of them with Jewish-sounding surnames or Anglo names, but with Jewish facial appearance, to attack Trump and Putin from the far right and demoralize us in the process. Do not listen to them. Jewish Marxist Vorwärts libeled Hitler as a paid agent of Russian Jews. These are inserts with images. The Great One sued Vorwärts and won. Otto Strasser and his brother Gregor were leaders of the leftist faction of the NSDAP. This shady pro-Soviet Union traitor was forced to flee Germany and then supported the Allies' genocidal war against Germany, spread the lie that Hitler had been a Bavarian communist. More. Adam Green of No More News and one of his frequent guests, Christopher John Berknes, often and viciously attacked Hitler, Putin, Trump, and Q from the far right. The Journey's ridiculous comic book titles, Adolf Hitler, Bolshevik and Zionist, and Putin's Reign of Terror, featuring a bloody Leon Trotsky on the cover. In Trump's case, the nasty smear has proven to be much stickier than it was when applied to the Great One, and that's because Trump's necessary strategy of keeping your enemies close created by design the impression that he really was in love with and beholden to devious demons such as Sheldon Adelson, Bibi's Satan Yahoo, the APAC crowd at all. This strategic embrace of the Zio crazies, coupled with equally cosmetic overtures toward the globalist left on various issues, made it easier to attack him from the far right and pick off many sunshine patriots from the pro-Trump ranks and our own donor subscription list in the process. In Trump's case, the military supervised Operation Warp Speed voluntary vaccine used by Trump to end the dangerous perma lockdowns and prevent the deep state from rolling out years from now an actual mandatory genocide jab with nanotech tracking chips linked to the cloud, has also been used to brand him as a willful mass murderer in the league of the WHO, Bill Gates, and Anthony Fauci. I like that. I call him Tony the Rat. He calls him Anthony Fauci. Now that Trump's true position has become apparent to all who've read, with an open, passionless, and critical thinking mind, that is, my compelling pieces defending him against such false charges, here, 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 and here, we can all say with certainty that the Donald has outmaneuvered both the Zionist faction and the globalist faction at every turn. The unremitting and intense hate articles and TV hit pieces still being machine gun fired at ex-President Trump every single day by the Juden press, all that one needs to confirm whose side Trump is on, namely ours. Those bloggers and podcasters, many of them self-described former Trump supporters, who continue to attack Trump from the far right, be it out of sincere emotionalized ignorance or due to fiendish cunning, are actually making hateful common cause with Sulzberger's New York Times, Soros's Move On, and Redfield's Economist. Think about that for a moment. Let it sink in. And be very careful with such right-wing sources. Deep state demonizer to his far-right target whispering, Trump is a globalist PSYOP agent. He works for the Jews and Big Pharma. Epstein had sex tapes on him and 1 billion people will die from his vaccine. Or another, from the headline, it could take 5 years for two leading COVID-19 vaccines to debut, AI analyst finds. The globalists were going to keep us shut down and starving for up to 5 years with new variants and a long wait for a mandatory vaccine with microchips in it. The vaccines would have come anyway. Trump had no way of preventing them. Humanity demanded a vaccine to end lockdowns. Trump pulled the agenda more than a year forward. By doing so, he saved the world from destruction. He constantly promoted cures, which eliminate the need for a vaccine. He constantly opposed the mandates. He said nobody has to be afraid of COVID. He supports his allies who warned about the vaccines. Donald Trump has outfoxed the Zionist, understanding the two faces of Donald Trump. Don Trumpettione disposes of yet another Jewish mobster, comparing him to Don Corleone. Pretty striking stuff. I think Mike King has basically got it right. And when in doubt, just review that list of all the accomplishments Trump has done for us, for you, for me, for the American people, even for the world.
Like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Now, there's a fascinating article I've just published on my blog at jameshfetzer.org by Phil Giraldi, who's a very serious guy. Listen to this. Philip Giraldi, Trump is toast. Jewish power will trump Trump. There is considerable irony in the fact that Donald Trump, when president, virtually crawled to do Israel's bidding more than any of his predecessors. He moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He accepted brutal Israeli settlement and control of the Palestinian West Bank, approved of the Israeli annexation of the Syrian Golan Heights, and ignored repeated Israeli war crimes using U.S.-provided weapons. Yet, for all his gifts to Israel, which do not serve any actual U.S. interest, he is currently being crucified by the Jewish-Israeli lobby because of an idiotic dinner with a pair of alleged anti-Semites, one of whom has been labeled a Holocaust denier. And the extreme reaction of Jewish groups to the affront also itself possesses a certain irony, in that it demonstrates how extraordinarily powerful promoters of Jewish and Israeli interests actually are, something that those selfsame groups take pains to deny at every opportunity, just as they deny having dual loyalty to Israel. The fact is that force majeure will prevail, and we will now see the deliberate and methodical destruction of Donald J. Trump's 2024 proposed presidential campaign by American Jewish and Israeli apologists. Trump had already been taken out to the back woodshed for a good whipping once after he posted a comment on his Truth Social network on October 16th. He boasted how no president has done more for Israel than I have. Somewhat surprisingly, however, our wonderful evangelicals are far more appreciative of this than the people of the Jewish faith, especially those living in the U.S. U.S. Jews have to get their act together and appreciate what they have in Israel before it's too late. But the rage unleashed by folks like the Anti-Defamation League's Jonathan Greenblatt, who labeled the October 16 comment as insulting and disgusting, combined with the attacks on three black celebrities, is already beginning to produce pushback, particularly from many normally apolitical blacks who are upset at the viciousness of the Jewish take no prisoners response due to its perceived racial overtones. Other observers also are concerned at how the Jewish groups and individuals are overstating the significance of some of the alleged anti-Semitic incidents by their definition in a self-serving effort to validate the view that Jewish suffering is unique and cannot be compared with other crimes against humanity. Also, for those who choose to defend the First Amendment right to free speech, it is discouraging to observe how it is possible to say nearly anything as long as it does not offend Jewish sensibilities. There have already been moves in Congress to criminalize criticism of Jews or Israel, making such actions the ultimate hate crime. Those specifically Jewish sensibilities absurdly include declaring anyone to be an anti-Semite who criticizes the behavior of Israel as it destroys schools and shoots a Palestinian teenager nearly every day. Indeed, the U.S. media of late has been awash with stories about surging anti-Semitism, which, taken all together, celebrate Israeli Jewish victimhood while also ignoring Jerusalem's war crimes and focusing instead on alleged conspiracies against Jews. Most despicable of all in the eyes of those protectors of all things Jewish are the few visible critics who have recognized that the standard Holocaust narrative that has been artfully and deliberately shaped since the Second World War is full of inconsistencies and errors in demonstrable fact. So-called Holocaust deniers are denigrated beyond all others because they attack the very raison d'etre that constitutes the miraculous Israel creation myth. And here I've added a link to my own work, my own research on the Holocaust narrative, politics, Trump science, and included a photograph of the British football team at Auschwitz. What? You didn't know there was a British soccer team at Auschwitz? Well, they're all looking very fit and cheerful. Examining what Kanye West and Donald Trump did and said suggests there's been considerable overreaction from the Greenblatts of this world and their allies in the media and in government. Starting with Kanye West, currently going by the name Yee, one finds that his initial comments made were not particularly startling, suggesting that Jews directly own or control and manage the entertainment industry in the United States, which is manifestly true. As a criticism of Yee, who believes that blacks are descended from the ancient Hebrews, intensified, he responded with some heat, eventually coming out with an incoherent tweet to Go DEFCON 3 on Jewish people. The comedian Dave Chappelle followed up on the controversy by delivering a stinging monologue on Saturday Night Live on the Jews and their numbers in the entertainment industry, saying it's not crazy, a crazy thing to think that Jews exert outside influence in Hollywood and the media. He also suggested that Kanye had violated Hollywood's rules of perception, saying, if they're black, then it's a gang. If they're Italian, it's a mob. But if they're Jewish, it's a coincidence and you should never speak about it. If Greenblatt had ignored Yee, it is likely that his poorly expressed comments would have been quickly forgotten. But that is not how the Greenblatts of this world operate. Every offense against the standard narrative of Jewish victimhood requires full-scale war. Reports early last week suggest that the efforts by ADL and others to convince businesses associated with Yee to cut off all ties with him have been successful, meaning that he is no longer a billionaire and likely has a fortune reduced to something in the $400 million range. There have been similar responses to the basketball player Kyrie Irving's recent tweet supporting so-called Black Hebrew-Israelite theory that he shares with Yee, which asserts that blacks are in fact Jews, while black comedian Dave Chappelle making fun of the ADL overreaction on Saturday Night Live is under the gun from that organization, which has accused him of popularizing and normalizing anti-Semitism. Kyrie Irving, who also believes the earth is flat, was denounced as a person unfit to associate with by his team owner and was suspended for 8 games without pay by the Brooklyn Nets, even though he characteristically offered several abject apologies. This all led up to the dinner at Mar-a-Lago with Yee and a so-called white supremacist, Nick Fuentes. It's not clear what was discussed at dinner, but Yee states that Trump was impressed by Fuentes. In the aftermath of the meal, when news of it appeared in the media, a shitstorm erupted. Trump claimed both that he did not know Fuentes and that he had been tricked by Yee, that the man brought to the meal is the man brought to the meal is Yee's guest. Those assertions, most likely lies, have been assailed over the media and also by the usual suspects like Greenblatt, who announced that the normalization of anti-Semitism is here. On the following day, Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democrat majority leader and himself a Jew who fancies himself the protector of Israel in the Senate, went to the Senate floor to denounce Trump's actions as disgusting and dangerous before calling them pure evil. Prominent Republicans like Kevin McCarthy and Marco Rubio have also piled on, suggesting that Trump will find little support even among those politicians he would normally consider to be favorable to his reelection. Notably, the Republican Jewish Coalition has joined in the attacks, which means that campaign money will not be flowing to Trump from that usually reliable source. And even Trump's former lawyer and the man he named ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, has condemned his old boss and patron, saying, even a social visit from an anti-Semite like Kanye West and human scum like Nick Fuentes is unacceptable. Ironically, Friedman, whose loyalty to the United States might be considered questionable, was a persistent apologist for Israel during his time in that country, rather than a promoter of U.S. interests. I have to confess that I had never heard of Nick Fuentes, so I had little checking on the claim that he was a Holocaust denier. Fuentes is well documented as making comments reflecting his rather intense dislike for Jews. But concerning the Holocaust, all I could come up with was a comment allegedly made by him, attacking the claim that 6 million Jews died in what have been described as death camps, with a suggestion that it was more likely 200,000 to 300,000 as a realistic figure, supported by official and other records. He described those deaths as cookies, which are baked in the oven, which may have angered critics more than the comment about the numbers. Interestingly, the 6 million number is one of the more ridiculous assertions that are part and parcel of the Holocaust narrative, as it appears to have been arbitrarily arrived at as acceptable, and there's considerable disagreement over its reliability. So, Fuentes, it seems, is not a Holocaust denier. Rather, he appears to be skeptical regarding the standard narrative, as am I, and many others who have bothered to look into the verifiable historical record. But that does not mean that anyone in power will be standing in line to excuse his behavior. And his dinner partner, Donald Trump, has evidently now outstayed his welcome by the standards of the noble protectors of Jewish and Israeli interests. The large dollops of campaign cash will not be coming in. Those willing to endorse his candidacy will be far fewer. And the media will turn on him more than it has done over the past 6 years. Indeed, it is doing so already. There are numerous articles in the mainstream every day telling over and over again the tale of the fateful dinner at Mar-a-Lago. Trump has clearly crossed the notorious red line on Jewish issues. The only remaining question is what it will do to people like Greenblatt. If he keeps hammering away, which he will because that is how he is wired, could the worm turn? And will Americans be wondered how 2% of the population has obtained so much power? That would be a really interesting development. Phil Giraldi. You can find that on my blog at jameshfetzer.org, along with a photograph and a link to my research on the Holocaust. And let me tell you, it does not take a great deal of effort for the whole thing to fall apart. Phil Giraldi suggested the figure of the 6 million was arbitrary, but that's not actually the case. It turns out that there have been, or were, 236 references to 6 million Jews in dire straits or fear of loss of their lives in the international press, beginning in 1890, long before the Nuremberg tribunals following World War II. In other words, that figure had been massively used again and again and again. It is, of course, the case that it does not appear to be derived from any historical or factual sources, but rather a disputed passage in Leviticus that has been interpreted as meaning that the chosen people can only return to the promised land when there are minus 6 million who have been consumed in the flames. But even that requires an interpolation, because there was no number for 6 million in the original Hebrew. So we get the official account, the official narrative, which I've investigated. I mean, look, it's like when I was a delegate to the 14th World Convention on Christian Education from the Episcopal Diocese of Los Angeles, representing the Young People's Fellowship, held in Tokyo that year. I went to Communist Party headquarters in Tokyo and asked for copies of some of their documents. I still have them today. I wanted to see what they have to say. And I was only then just graduated from high school and matriculating to Princeton, where I'd served 4 wonderful years that made a huge difference to my life, where I chose to major in philosophy, not recognizing at the time that Princeton was number one in the world in math, physics, and philosophy, and where I did my undergraduate thesis for, among professional philosophers, the most famous philosopher of science in the world, Carl G. Hempel, on whom I have subsequently published 2 volumes, for Oxford University Press and authored the entry on Carl Hempel in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. He made a tremendous impact on my life. Well, the official narrative, and by the way, no one denies that World War II was in some broad extended sense a Holocaust. Millions of people died, including, no doubt, millions of Jews. The question is, were 6 million Jews exterminated in concentration camps? Were they put to death in mass in special gas chambers? Was the gas used to kill them Zyklon B, which is a form of cyanide? Well, it turns out none of those claims are true. There's a huge amount of research about this, really a vast amount. It turns out that the International Committee of the Red Cross was keeping documents, recordings of every prisoner in the camp, their age, their sex, their race, their nationality, their cause of death. They kept all these records. They were very meticulous. They originally had concluded that a total of, get this, 271,301 had died from all causes combined. In 1993, they recalibrated. They went back over their numbers and arrived at a revised total of 296,081, none of whom died from being put to death in a gas chamber. So yeah, there were around 300,000 who died in these concentration camps. None of them, however, were put to death in a gas chamber. If you actually look at a map, for example, of Auschwitz, you find all kinds of features you might find surprising. They had, for example, a hospital with a surgical unit, obstetrical and gynecological block for inmates. They had a quarantine area for newly arriving prisoners. They had a brothel, an art museum, a library, a wood shop for woodworking and sewing. They had a concert hall where the orchestra played Sunday concerts. Indeed, hundreds of children were born in these so-called death camps. How is that consistent with the official narrative? Hundreds of children. In his sensational book, Breaking the Spell, the British historian aside, Nick Kohlerstrom, who invited me to compose the introduction to his book, includes photographs, for example, illustration 6, children being liberated from the Buchenwald camp near Weimar. They appear as being relaxed, well-fed, and trusting of the adults around them. Buchenwald experiences a bit of problem with tourists who come expecting to be shown the gas chambers and have to be told that, sorry, there never were any. Here's another illustration 25. Healthy-looking children in Birkenau being liberated by the Red Army. Indeed, he has a photograph, illustration 28. A British football team at Auschwitz. I love it. I even put it on my tweet about this wonderful article by Phil Giralde. Wonderful article by Phil Giralde. So if you want to check it out, do that. It's very interesting, by the way, historically, that there were two trials for a Holocaust denier in Canada by the name of Ernst Zundel in 1985 and 1988. Which Robert Forasson has documented. You can find his article on the Zundel trials at the Institute for Historical Review. What was most stunning about the two trials is that in 1985, the prosecutor could not find a single witness who would testify under oath to having seen anyone put to death in a gas chamber, not one. In 1988, perhaps even more sensationally, the defense produced the world's leading expert on gas chambers, Fred Luchter, who'd actually been sent to the camps, conducted scientific studies, took samples from the chambers, and came back to report during the second trial that there was nothing at any of the camps that could have remotely served as a gas chamber. In other words, the whole story was a myth. They were using Zyklon B, which is a mild form of cyanide, to delouse the inmates, to kill the body lice, which are spreading typhus and dysentery, for the simple reason they might wanted to maintain the health of the inmate because you can't get work out of a corpse. These were labor camps that were established to help the war effort. They were established near munitions plant, tank assembly, and so forth. They used them as slave labor, yes. But they were not putting them to death in mass. There were no gas chambers. And while Zyklon B was being used, it was to preserve the health of the inmates. There's been a whole lot of research on this, very scientific. I highly recommend Nick's book, Breaking the Spell, which, by the way, had the additional benefit of having access to the British death books. During World War II, Alan Turing, a brilliant computer scientist, cracked the German code. So the British had copies of all the German records, and they were very meticulous and very detailed. And because of access to the death books, Nick Colliston was able to confirm the records of the International Committee of the British Red Cross. So the total of all inmates who died in all of the camps was around 300,000, none of whom died from being put to death in a gas chamber using Zyklon B. So if you look at the evidence, you'll find the truth.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
There has been the rather sensational development that I may have already reported, but was certainly worth reporting again, that Bobby Kennedy endorsed Tucker Carlson's report from an expert in relation to the files about the assassination that Biden has still refused to release. The CIA murder of my uncle was a coup d'etat from which democracy has never recovered. Tucker reported, and I'm sure I must have shared with you, he asked an expert on the contents of the files as to what they contained and whether or not they confirmed that the CIA was involved in the assassination of JFK. And the answer he got was yes. The CIA was involved in the assassination of JFK. Now, I've got to say, while I'm a huge fan of Tucker and endorse his show as the only worth watching regularly, I mean, others hit and miss. Laura's usually pretty good. Sean Hannity often has excellent guests, though in my opinion, he's a mediocre intellect. Tucker, by contrast, has high intelligence, very analytical, knows what he's talking about. But he has seemed to me to be very wet behind the ears when it comes to conspiracies. Heretofore, I've even shared with friends, I think he may still think that Lee Oswald shot JFK. So I was really, really pleased when he came across with all of this. And we're Friday, Bobby Jr. responded to the Tucker Carlson report. Not only was Robert's uncle assassinated, but his father, of course, was also assassinated while he was running for president. And based on my research, the CIA had a role in that, too. It was done with a different MO, of course. He wasn't riding in an open convertible in a public space. He was actually led by one of his aides into the pantry when he was supposed to exit through the great hall of the Ambassador Hotel there, the general ballroom, but is diverted to the pantry where the security guard beside him, Thane Eugene Caesar, shot him behind the right ear with the same caliber weapon that Sirhan Sirhan had already begun firing in an effort to distract everyone. I mean, it was a brilliant op. So you got Sirhan the Patsy firing away multiply with the same type of handgun as Caesar has. And while everyone's distracted, he shoots him from an inch and a half behind the right ear. And then as he falls, he fires three more shots, two of which hit Bobby and one of the third of which only passes through his clothing. And he's lying there on the floor with a tie clasped. Actually, I think it's a clip-on tie line that he grabbed off of Caesar, thereby identifying who had shot him. And, of course, he lingered for 12 hours. And I tweeted to RFK Jr., I admired your uncle and your father. I would have gladly given my life for theirs. If you want to know what the CIA has been covering up, here's a distillation of 30 years of collaborative research with the best experts to ever study the case. The Real Deal, November 18, 2021, JFK special, dedicated to Oliver Stone, whose new film will be released on 22 November 2021. His JFK was a masterpiece with three flaws. He didn't know that his Zapruder film had been massively edited. He didn't know that Lee Oswald was actually standing in the doorway of the book depository when the motorcade came by. And he'd posited three when there actually turned out to have been eight assassins in Dealey Plaza. I've also tweeted another interview I did with Jeremy out of South Africa on germ, J-E-R-M, warfare.com. Jeremy interviewed me about the JFK cover-up. No, Lee Oswald did not shoot JFK. He was actually standing in the doorway of the book depository when the JFK motorcade passed by. He not only can't be the lone gunman, but cannot have been one of eight shooters. Now, it turns out that in order to understand the assassination, you need to distinguish between the sponsors, the facilitators, and the mechanics. The sponsors, those who wanted JFK out, principally for reasons of policy, except in one instance for revenge, included the CIA, the Joint Chiefs, anti-Castro Cubans, the Mafia, the Fed, Texas oilmen, and Israel. The CIA, because JFK was threatening to shatter it into 1,000 pieces. In the wake of the Bay of Pigs, he felt he'd been betrayed and misled. He fired the two deputy directors of the CIA, Richard Bissell and Charles Cabell. Both of them were icons of the intel industry. Cabell was an Air Force general whose brother Earl was the mayor of Dallas at the time of the motorcade and who had joined the CIA in 1957. The Joint Chiefs. They threw in because they'd come to believe that JFK was an obstacle to combating communism because he had not invaded Cuba, contrary to their unanimous recommendation. He'd signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union, contrary to their unanimous opposition. And now he was pulling all of our forces out of Vietnam by the end of 1964. Where they believed a stand had to be taken against the expansion of international godless communism. Anti-Castro Cubans were upset with Jack because they believed falsely that he had betrayed them at the Bay of Pigs. This was not true, but it was convenient for the CIA to allow them to hold that belief so that their anger wouldn't be directed at the agency itself, the mafia. Jack, of course, had appointed Bobby as his attorney general. And Bobby was bringing about more indictments and more convictions, more prosecutions, more convictions than ever before in history. Where even Edgar was unable to acknowledge the existence of organized crime in America, because just as Edgar had sex dossiers on the members of the Congress, the House, and the Senate, the mafia had sex dossiers on Hoover, including Edgar in, shall we say, compromising positions with his close personal aide, Tolson. And they were compromising indeed. Edgar, many don't know, liked to wear a dress and be called Mary and play the role of a woman. Clyde Tolson, close personal friend. So that Edgar didn't even acknowledge the existence of organized crime until the Valachi hearings, where a high-ranking member of the mafia outlined the organization of the structure with such clarity and detail it was no longer politically possible to deny. Then we got the Fed, the banks surrounding the Federal Reserve, which is a private consortium. Most people think the Fed must be a government entity. No, it's a consortium of private banks, where Jack had sought to circumvent the Fed. I believe he actually would have rendered it impotent, null and void, by directing the Department of Treasury to print United States notes. Where I remember as a young Marine Corps officer holding one in my hand, and it had a red embossed imprint that said United States note instead of green embossing Federal Reserve note, because he thought it was ridiculous for the United States to pay interest to a consortium of private banks to print the currency of the United States when the United States could print its own currency for free, interest free. Many don't realize that the so-called national debt is mostly interest owed to the Fed for printing the currency of the United States. How absurd is that? Texas oilmen were upset because Jack was threatening to cut oil depletion allowance, something like 23.5%, that they were granted on the ground that oil was a finite resource, and by pumping it out of the ground, they were putting themselves out of business. I mean, it was ridiculous. We know today, of course, that Earth produced oil. It's not a fossil fuel. It's not the remnant of dead dinosaurs. It's naturally produced by Earth in endless quantity. And finally, Israel. Jack was at loggerheads with David Ben-Gurion, who had been a founder and the first prime minister of Israel, over Ben-Gurion's desire that Israel have nuclear weapons, which Jack opposed on the ground that it would set off a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. So those were the sponsors, the mechanics, where the shooters are supervisors and coordinators, who included, hold your breath, George Herbert Walker Bush and Edward Lansdale. Lansdale was another Air Force general who was responsible for assassination programs all over the world, but especially in Vietnam, Operation Phoenix. G.H.W. Meade actually supervised the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was codenamed Operation Zapata. The Bush oil drilling company was named Zapata. I believe had it been a success, the Bush family would have had a concession to drill all over the Caribbean basin. He renamed two of the ships, one Barbara, another Houston, just what he did when he was a pilot in World War II. He named his planes Barbara, after his wife. Now, the shooters represented each of the sponsors, plus the key guy behind the scene. For example, the CIA shooter appears to have been Roscoe White. He was a Dallas, recently joined Dallas policeman with ties to the CIA. He fired a shot from the grassy knoll with a handgun. It would have been, say, the easiest shot, but because Jackie would have been hit and they were under explicit instruction she not be harmed, he pulled the shot. The slug wound up in the grass, but it was picked up by a Dallas detective and never seen again. The Joint Chiefs, their guy was named Jack Lawrence. He was an Air Force expert. He was inside the Triple Underpass. He fired a shot through the windshield, hit Jack in the throat. Small, clean puncture wound described three times by Malcolm Perry, M.D., the physician who attended the wound, as a wound of entry. The bullet was coming at him using a rifle that was a new collapsible, a fold-upable, high-velocity weapon that had, it appears, given to him by Curtis LeMay, the head of the Air Force, so that he would know that he was acting at the request of the military, who'd become convinced that JFK was a communist who had to be removed from office. Anti-Castro Cubans. Nestor Tony Escadro was in the second floor of the Daltags, firing from the window of a broom closet owned by a uranium mining company that was actually an asset for the CIA. He fired three shots with a Mannlicher Carcano, the same type of weapon Lee Oswald is alleged to have used, which were the only unsilent shot fired during the assassination to create the acoustical impression of only three shots having been fired. And when I, at a conference, had the opportunity to question a guy who was expert on the acoustical studies done by the House Special Committee on Assassinations, Select Committee on Assassinations, to review the audio tape evidence. They were only allowed to test whether shots had been fired from the grassy knoll and from the book depository, not from any other location. And I asked him, I said, was it sufficiently discriminatory? You could tell the difference between shots fired from the Daltechs and shots fired from the book depository, and he acknowledged what I knew. No. No. So it set up in advance to guarantee they could not get evidence of shots fired from other locations. But in fact, no shots were fired from the sixth floor assassin's lair. And inside the Daltags, Tony Escadro was being supervised by George Herbert Walker Bush, who actually would be arrested when he came out of the building. He was never charged, but he was arrested and identified him as a Houston independent oil man, which was his cover in the CIA. Mafia. The mafia shooter appears to have been Frank Sturgis. He was located at the intersection of the Triple Underpass and the picket fence and fired the shot that entered JFK's right temple and blew his brains out the back of his head. Some of you may recall when Malcolm Kilduff, the acting press secretary, announced that JFK was dead. He pointed to his right temple and said it was a simple matter of a bullet right through the head, attributing that finding to Admiral George Berkeley, the president's personal physician. For that shot and the wound to the throat would be widely broadcast on radio television the very afternoon of the assassination. Then you had the Texas oilmen. Their guy appears to have been a Dallas deputy sheriff by the name of Harry Weatherford, who was on top of the county records building and implanted a Mannlicher Carcano bullet using a larger caliber weapon, a .30-06, and a plastic collar known as a sabot. Where the shot, as Roy Schaefer pointed out to me, actually passed through the upholstery of the limousine. Jack was wearing this heavy corset, a back brace, since he'd injured his back in World War II, saving a fellow sailor, PT-109 and all that. But it was a shallow shot, only went in about as far as the second knuckle on your little finger, We have the shirt, the jacket. You can see the hole, 5.5 inches below the collar. David W. Manning, MD, PhD, went to the National Archives and asked a member of the staff to actually put it on, put on the shirt, put on the jacket, and determined the hole in the shirt was ever so slightly below the hole in the jacket, indicating a shot at a slightly downward angle. Elm Street only had a 11-degree slope. Virtually, his Escadra was firing on the horizontal. Then Israel. Israel had a shooter who, to the best of my knowledge, is the only one still alive by the name of Clyde Forshaw, who was representing the Hoffman industry coming out of Toronto on behalf of Israel. And David, he was in the vicinity of Bergola. David now believes that there was a... Oh, I didn't account for all the shots fired by Escadro. One shot missed and it hit a distant curbing and injured a bystander by the name of James Tague. Another missed and hit a chrome strip over the windshield. But the third, after the driver, William Greer, pulled the limousine to the left into a halt, hit JFK in the back of the head, right in the vicinity of the external occipital protuberance, that bump on your head where you'd rest if you were reclining in a bathtub. And he slumped forward, Jack eased him back up. He'd already been hit in the back. He'd already been hit in the throat, but he was still alive. And that's when he was hit in the right temple by the shot fired by Sturgis. It blew his brains out the back of the head, and David now believes virtually simultaneously by shot than would be by Forshaw, the side of the head. And then there was two other shooters. One was on the south knoll. This is a single tree there, opposite the grass. You know, you wouldn't even think there was room enough for a shooter to be located. But I've seen photographs in the possession of two different experts on JFK where he's standing. These are different photographs, standing holding his rifle. And by my discernment, he must represent the Fed, the Eastern Establishment, though I've not yet been able to identify his name, rank, and serial number. Nor, for that matter, what shot he took or what effect it may have had, which is untrue for the others. The first six, I've identified by name, rank, and serial number. The seventh, Ole Domegaard, with which I agree. But there was an eighth shooter. He was in the book depository, on the west side of the building, not the east, where the sniper's lair, so-called, was located. He fired one or more shots at John Connolly in the mistaken belief that it was Ralph Yarborough, who is a liberal Texas senator that Lyndon despised. A big argument that morning between LBJ and JFK, where Lyndon wanted to get Connolly out. Connolly was his crony, his campaign manager and all that, and Yarborough in, but Jack overrode him on the ground that the chief executive of the state must ride with the chief executive, should ride with the chief executive of the United States. They couldn't get the word out. It was too late. And this was Malcolm Mack Wallace, who was LBJ's personal hitman. He murdered a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters. The whole event began in Los Angeles in 1960, when Jack beat Lyndon for the nomination of the Democratic Party. Jack invited Stuart Symington, a senator from Missouri, to be his running mate, but gave him overnight to think about it. Meanwhile, Bobby made a pro forma visit to the Johnson suite to offer him the opportunity to run, never imagining he'd have the least interest, and Lyndon jumped on it. He said he'd expose Jack had Addison's disease, wasn't expected to live a long, healthy life, that among his dalliances had been one with a beautiful woman who was a spy for East Germany, and that if he were not on the ticket, then any legislative proposal set down by the White House would be dead on arrival, because in his position as a powerful majority leader of the Senate, he would bottle them up. Bobby and Jack tried to figure a way out, but they were boxed in, and he had to accede to Lyndon's demands. When one of Johnson's wealthy backers heard Lyndon would be running with Jackie, burst into the Johnson suite, cursing and swearing because now LBJ would help JFK become president. Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles. He said that was an excellent plan. Bobby Baker would later declare in public that Jack Kennedy would not live out his first term and that he would die a violent death. And in the sequence of events, Lyndon Johnson would send his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. If you go to my Twitter account, at Jim Fetzer, you can check out a couple of my distillations of 30 years of research with the best experts to ever study the case. When we come back, I'm going to open the phone lines. I would really like those from whom I've not heard, especially first-time callers, to call in 540-352-4452. 540-352-4452. Mitchell will take your call and get you on the air. Please join me. And, of course, in blackmailing Jack, forcing him to put him on the ticket, he was using information provided him by J. Edgar Hoover, to whom Lyndon would, when he became president, assign sole investigative responsibility. And remember, as president, he was in a position to guarantee that no one would ever suffer for participating in the assassination of his predecessor, JFK.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, on Studio B for Momentary Zen, with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes. That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building. Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people.
The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
So I'm truly distraught at the prospect that Elon Musk might step down as CEO. I don't know who else would have the intelligence, the integrity, the courage to make all these things happen. Now, there are those who are not Musk enthusiasts who think there's some kind of game being played here. And I acknowledge that no doubt the situation is complex. No doubt he has multiple motives, but he's doing something so good, so powerful, so important. I've been taking advantage of it since I was reinstated, what, maybe a month ago? You want to check out at Jim Fetzer. Check out at Jim Fetzer. And if you're on Twitter at all, and I encourage you to join. This really is the new commons, the new open area where the public discourse can take place. Meanwhile, there are a lot who want to promote Ron DeSantis in lieu of Donald Trump. Trump, of course, is a flawed candidate, no one denies. But look at that list that Mike King elaborated of accomplishments of Donald Trump. I mean, astonishing, astonishing. And what do we have now? A small Twitter user exposes Ron DeSantis' potential neocon baggage. Another Bush McCain? Get this. This is Leskov Brandonovic. Breskov Brandonovic. No one ever heard of him. But he's been raising some questions about DeSantis that are certainly worth thinking about. Here's one tweet. And again, this is all on Twitter. Congressman Ron DeSantis was very upset about Trump. I mean, very positive about Putin, wanting more lethal aid for Ukraine. Right now, people are still suffering while McConnell is still working hard to send more money to Ukraine. In the meantime, this is a guy GOPE, meaning online, is pushing. Here's another. For those who may say that was from years ago, this was him this year calling Putin a gas station attendant while being just a governor. Imagine what he would do if he became the president. You don't provoke a country with a large amount of nuclear warheads like this. Again, he's also a strong advocate for military ops in Afghanistan, said we need to use everything in our arsenal. Trump, however, made a concrete plan to get troops out of there, though the evacuation was poorly executed by Biden. Trump is not a warmonger. Can't say the same for Lil D, meaning DeSantis. Unlike with being a governor, foreign policy has a massive role to play in being president. The fate of the entire nation is at stake. Here's another tweet. Making foreign policies is a major part of being POTUS, especially on wars. And yet, based on the record, Trump without baggage does not even remotely resemble Trump on this. Instead, he has almost the exact same stance as the Bushes and McCain. And it's very dangerous. Of course, these select quotes are not dispositive, but merely serve as evidence that DeSantis will need to clarify his foreign policy stance as he emerges from one of the greatest, if not the greatest, governorships to a new role as a politician with national ambitions. There is time for him to clarify and evolve his positions if necessary. Both DeSantis and Trump are excellent, and to make them even more excellent, we do them a service not to withhold constructive criticism. And of course, we must give credit where due. DeSantis is rightly lauded as a hero for his brave, principled, and wise leadership during the COVID era. Just a few days ago, he took yet another important step toward accountability for the criminals who have foisted the COVID regime upon the country. Good stuff. We do have a call from a regular. I do want those of you who've never called in before to take advantage. I really appreciate a diversity of voices. Meanwhile, Brian, what are your latest thoughts?
Well, I wanted to relay a story to you that was told to me by one of my sprinkler customers. I used to, you know, fix lawn sprinklers, who had dealings with LBJ. And so you won't hear this story anywhere. And he was the manager of the bar of some hotel back in, was it 1968, when LBJ was campaigning for president. And he said that that day when LBJ was there, he was passing out dollars to all the black employees of this hotel. And then that night, he called down and wanted a bottle of scotch or something. But it was after hours. He was not allowed to, you know, to have this bottle because I don't know if it's a liquor law or whatever. So he told LBJ, look, it's after hours, so I'm going to have to personally bring the bottle up to you. So he went up, knocked on the door, and LBJ answered in his bathrobe or whatever, and gave him the bottle, and he looked in the bed, and LBJ had a call girl in the bed, and he just beat the crap out of her. He said her face was all bruised up, her eyes were swelling up. He just beat the crap out of this poor girl. So that was a story relayed by one of my sprinkler customers.
Well, I don't know how seriously to take that for the following reason. LBJ used to boast he had more women by accident than JFK had had on purpose. And I do believe that was probably true. I don't think Lyndon would have had any reason to beat up a woman. I'm not going to say
he's a sociopath, you know, when they're evil like that, they'll do things like that. So anyway, story he relayed to me. I'm sorry.
And you're relating it to me, and I'm telling you why I'm a bit of a skeptic about this story. I had over 100 hours of conversation, 100 conversation with Madeline Duncan Brown, who is a mistress of Lyndon. They began an affair in 1948. She bore him a son, Stephen, in 1950. She would be invited to all these social events because their relationship was well known. But I think if Lyndon had any violent tendencies, I would have heard about it from Madeline. God knows she spent enough time with him. For example, she was invited to an event at the home of Clint Murchison the night before the assassination. This is one of the great oil barons. J. Edgar was there. He would typically stop in Dallas on his way to California to the Del Mar racetrack. When we put down a bet, he would invariably win. It turns out the racetrack was owned by Clint Murchison, Sr. She thought perhaps it was in his honor because when he came to town, they typically have a little fete for Edgar. But there were other power players there. You know, Richard Nixon was there. John J. McCloy was there. Late in the evening, to her surprise, Lyndon Johnson showed up. And these heavy hitter disappeared into a boardroom for 10 or 15 minutes. And when it broke up, he strode over toward her. She told me she expected he was going to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. And Ted, he told her in a hateful tone of voice, I'm not going to be embarrassed by those Kennedy boys any longer after tomorrow. That's not a threat. That's a promise. The following day, he called and said the same thing. Well, 6 weeks later, on New Year's Eve, they had a rendezvous in the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, where she confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. And Lyndon blew up at her and told her the oil boys and the CIA had decided that Jack had to be taken out. Now, I'm just telling you, I think that if Lyndon had this brutal aspect, I would have heard about it by now. I'm dealing with some of the leading experts on LBJ in the world today, including Phil Nelson, whose books about Lyndon Johnson are absolutely sensational. You've all heard about Robert Caro, who had a series on Lyndon, but when it came to the assassination, he just fell apart. He couldn't handle it. I think he was just astonished. He'd spent so much time archiving the life of a man who turned out to be ruthless and aggressive in promoting his own political ambitions. And Phil Nelson picked up basically roughly where Caro left off, except Phil did his own research. I say, if you read LBJ, Mastermind of JFK's Assassination, after the first few chapters, you're going to be convinced that this man had the very character to perpetrate, you know, the assassination of the president. During a conversation we had over lunch, Madeline said to me how John Connally had said to describe Lyndon would require every adjective in the dictionary. And it was clear she didn't understand what that had meant. So I explained to her what he was saying is that Lyndon had so many strengths, both for good and for evil, that would require all the positive, but also all the negative adjectives in the dictionary. So that's really what he meant. And Madeline hadn't pieced it together. I'm telling you, I'll ask Phil Nelson if there's anything to this, Brian. But honestly, my belief, as I sit here speaking with you right now, I'm a skeptic about that story. Now, I'm not going to say it's impossible. Where did this happen? Where did this happen specifically?
What it town? Was a hotel here and somewhere in Kansas City. He told me the hotel, but I can't remember. It was where he was staying when he was campaigning for president, when he stayed in Kansas City. And this gentleman was the manager of the bar in that hotel. So, and he was like 80 some years old at the time. So I just couldn't imagine him making it up. But anyway, that's what he relayed to me when we were talking.
Well, remember, LBJ actually did not campaign in 1968. He disavowed. He said, I will not accept the nomination of my party, and if elected, I will not serve as president of the United States. I think he was...
Okay, yeah, it was 64 then, so...
He was apprehensive that he would get waxed by one of the anti-war candidates. I mean, remember, Eugene McCarthy set off, and then Bobby realized this was his opportunity and got into the ring, and Lyndon would not have wanted to suffer the humiliation of having a Kennedy defeat him in a national campaign for president. Paul, you've joined. Please give us your thoughts.
Well, first of all, I would like to officially deny the Holocaust. I deny the Holocaust over and over and over. Second of all, what's all this about? You want new callers? You want some new voice? You want to hear some alternative voices? Come on, Jim. You only got four listeners. Me, Brian, Bruce. And
I love it, Paul. Go for it. You've certainly put me in my place. Go for it.
I didn't have a whole, lot else. I just wanted to jump in and say hi. I haven't called in a week or so, I think. Something like that.
Yeah, what do you think about this Musk stuff? You probably have a different opinion than I. I'd be keen to hear it.
Well, I've been been saying the same thing many times over a couple of years now. The same thing that Dave Scorpio says, that Elon Musk is not to be trusted. He's, in my opinion, he may be a little bit rogue here and there, but he's a deep state asset. I think there's a lot of evidence for this, his background, his parents, the fact that all the claims for his businesses, you know, financially, they don't add up. His net worth doesn't add up. It makes no sense. And that the SpaceX thing is just a big money vacuum, a lot of fraud there. I mean, the fraud of launching that Tesla Roadster into space, right? I mean, that's just one. You know, the fraud that he goes along with, right? The fraud of that rocket landing in reverse on that barge. I'm sure you're familiar with that as well. So, you know, I don't have any faith in Musk.
The truth is that until Musk took Twitter, I really hadn't paid him a lot of attention. So you're going to have a lot of information about him that I do not. By the way, I have a report right here that Facebook currently employs at least 115 in high-ranking positions who formerly worked at the FBI, the CIA, NSA, or DHS, 17 CIA, 37 FBI, 23 NSA, 38 DHS. Those are on Facebook. Now, I thought Musk was doing a great job of doing the house clean, getting rid of the censors, the four highest ranking. He's fired half of the staff at Twitter because their role was censorship. Paul, go ahead. Lay it on.
Well, just quickly, too, by the way, I just had a quick text from Mona, and she said, I'm a listener, too. How dare you? So you got
so there are actually, what, six of us? Very funny.
You know, here's the thing. You have to look into the background of this to know where this all comes from. So, for example, Facebook was started with money from InQtel. And InQtel, of course, as you probably know, is a fundraising arm of the CIA. So, again, Facebook serves dual purposes, or, you know, maybe even more than dual. But obviously, it's a gigantic vacuum cleaner for information, for personal information. People just willingly put on there anything and everything, including what they think, right? And of course, you know, it's just, you know, it's a perfect sponge for all sorts of information that, you know, is stored and cataloged and everything else. So I don't really use Facebook. I have gone to it on occasion and looked at things that people have posted. But yeah, so in other words, I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, everything that you see, you have to be careful. It's a story. It's a narrative. I'll state something else now, just for the fun of it. I'm going to be a little bit ahead here, but we can have another wager if you want. We've had several wagers. I'm going to wager that Trump will never be president again. As much as many might like that, I don't see a scenario in which it's allowed to happen unless it's what they want, and I don't believe it's what they want.
Okay, I get your wager. I'm listening. Mitchell says he's 20, listening, 20, so that 20, kicks that 20. That kicks the number up to seven. We got it. We're up to seven, Paul.
So what do you want to put on that? $20? I have a feeling that you think he will run and win, and you know, it would be better than the current situation, but I don't see it at this point.
Sure. I'll wager $20 on whether or not Trump should run again, at least, because if they don't fix the voting system, no Republican is going to win, Paul. I mean, it's just awful. I've been so happy to have Twitter as a forum for free speech again. Maybe I'm being less critical than I should have Musk. What is the game that is being played here with Twitter coming in, opening it up, dumping a lot of the trash, and then backing out or bowing out as CEO? I mean, he'll still own Twitter. Your further thoughts?
Well, you know, what is the game? It's the same game that's always played. It's keeping us titillated and entertained and maybe perplexed by irrelevant things. I mean, really think about Twitter. How important is Twitter in what's going on in this world, in this economy, in this government? How important is Facebook? How important is so many other things that they're obviously putting, you know, little drama plays up on the stage? They don't want the voting machines fixed, okay? They don't want honest elections, and so we're not going to have them. As I've kept saying over and over again, and I think you really know deep down in your heart, Jim, there's no political fix to this, okay? I'm not alone. There is no political fix to any of our current situation. Explain to me how a politician is going to run and get elected in our current system by promising to, for example, dissolve the Federal Reserve, pay off the national debt, and have our own national currency, or stop the chemtrail weather warfare operations that are global in nature, okay, and that are only destructive. Nothing constructive is occurring from this weather technology, which we actually could benefit by, and so on. The vaccine agenda, okay, the relentless, unending Pfizer commercials on every goddamn show you try to watch. Have you seen this? Have you tried to watch a sporting event and you either see one of two things? You see promoting of drugs and things by Pfizer and relentless race-mixing propaganda where they're constantly showing at least 50 to 60 or more percent of the commercials are all blacks. Blacks, you know, enjoying a middle-class lifestyle. Blacks doing this. Blacks doing that. Like I said, you've said it before yourself. When you watch the television, you think that half the country is black. And this is a brainwashing, mind control, propagandizing operation against white people, and it's ongoing, and it's not going to stop anytime soon, and it's certainly not going to stop by voting. So there you go, my normal rant. Thanks for hearing it.
No, that's all good, Paul. Brian, you want to add some further thoughts?
Well, he's spot on. I wouldn't take that bet, Jim. I don't think Trump will even be allowed to run for president. It just won't even happen. And everything he says is spot on. When you talk about Facebook, I tried to, talk to Louise on Goldfish Report because she was having energetic attacks, and I couldn't get through on my computer. So I said, maybe if I get on Facebook, I can leave her messages that way. And I just didn't put anything in there about who I was or anything. And then I had 10 friend requests. I thought, what the hell's going on? And then the next day I'd remove them. There'd be another 10 friend requests. And it would just go on and on. And I noticed a pattern that after a while, it was all beautiful women. Okay, and I would remove them. Then the next day, it'd be like 13 friend requests, and it would be all people that looked gay. And then when I would remove all this, suddenly I was starting to get friend requests from people in the Middle East that were writing in Arabic. So it was like their AI programming was trying to figure out who I liked, and I hadn't posted my age or anything. I mean, it was just nuts. So I just want to completely get off this Facebook thing, but I don't know how to do it, and I still can't get a hold of Louisa because when I try and go to Goldfish Report, it still won't let me talk to her. So anyway, so hey, that's what
quickly,
I have to say.
I'm going to react to that, Jim, if you don't mind, and just
go ahead.
reinforce what Brian has said here. So you probably don't care about this stuff, and you may not even notice it since you're older and you've been married for so long and so forth. But yes, this is a well-known function of Facebook to constantly keep, especially if they, know that a single male is there, constantly put out these friend requests for women you don't know. And also I get all these friend requests occasionally from just weird foreigners, In other words, why would I want to be friends with some Asian or some Arab or whatever? It's just absolutely absurd. I think it's a combination of titillation and distraction, keeping people all wrapped up in frivolous, personal things and so sexual, romantic possibilities. Meanwhile, all the serious topics that people can and have want to discuss on Facebook, you've heard all the stories about they put a video up or they put a link up about, critical of the election fraud or the vaccines or anything else, and those things get taken down. So we know from that right there what the purpose of Facebook really actually is.
Well, Facebook began as a CIA project called LifeLog, and it was always intended to be a psyop in the following sense of giving the public or participants the opportunity to share all kinds of very detailed personal information that the CIA otherwise would not have access to. So I think as a as a gathering part, as a kind of a siphon for information about individuals, has been a sensational, a brilliant success. But I agree, it had these intel roots. And I think in the end, you know, if we could dispense with the CIA in totality, that the world would be overwhelmingly better off. Harry Truman said it was the greatest mistake of his presidency, the creation of the agency. And, of course, it's performing all kinds of acts that are illegal in the United States, and coups and assassinations outside. And it just the history of the agency is a god-awful indictment of the United States as a criminal or rogue state. We are really the terrorist state among all. This might be a point on which the three of us would agree, or the other of my audience of seven.
Yeah, I think we all agree on that.
That's good, Paul. That's good. So we'll see what is to come. I don't know if Musk were to step down, I don't know what would happen at Twitter. I'd probably get banned all over again. Who the hell knows? I want to thank you all for calling in. We'll be back on Wednesday. See you then.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Paul. Brian.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence...